Welcome back to Killer Fun, where we explore the intersection of crime and entertainment every other week. I'm Christy.
And I'm Jackie.
And we're so glad that you're back with us today. Today! Happy Thanksgiving!
Happy Thanksgiving!
If you're listening to this on release day, it's Thanksgiving here in the U.S. If you're listening somewhere else or not on release day...
Well, then I hope you have a happy Thanksgiving or that you're celebrating a Thanksgiving with us for no reason at all, but to just join us.
That's right. Or if you're just having a great day, we wish you that as well. And
absolutely,
we're so glad that you're with us today to talk about
Tower Heist.
Okay. So before we do that, though, I got to remind everybody.
Oh, yes.
Send in your hometown crime stories.
Yes.
Just write it out, a little paragraph. It can be the weird murder that happened in or near your town.
Mm-hmm.
It can be the thing that happened to your grandma and she told you about it when you were visiting her or while you were visiting with her on Zoom, however you're doing Thanksgiving this year. Mm-hmm. You don't want to talk about politics. Ask about the hometown crime story. It can be the weird neighbor.
Oh, there's always one of those.
Turned out to be nefarious or only seemed nefarious.
Yeah, let us know. I mean, if it's your personal story, like as in you committed the crime, we wholly suggest that you leave that out because we don't want to know.
Oh, yeah. Blame it on your neighbor. I don't want to know that.
Nobody has a story like that they're going to send us.
Could be stupid criminal.
Oh, that's always a good one.
Those are always fun.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever it is, just send it.
Yes. Send it in. We've gotten a few.
Yeah.
We've gotten some coming in.
Yeah.
We're excited.
We've gotten some come in. But no matter where you're located, if you would like this super cool 2020 dumpster fire Christmas ornament, I'm giving one away to people who send it in.
Yay!
Send in your story. I'll mail it to you wherever you are with a little handwritten note. We would love to have lots of people to draw from to send this out. Send it in.
Let us know.
Let us know.
You need this ornament. You want to be in the drawing for this.
Yes.
This is important. Yes, it's important.
Sure.
Yes. We will have to remember this year and let us never forget what a dumpster fire 2020 has been.
It's not been a great year.
No.
It's not been a horrible year for me. I would say not my worst year. But
yeah, I would agree with that as well.
Even still, it's up there.
It's still up there. It's still a dumpster fire.
Yeah, it's still a dumpster fire.
I mean, thankfully, it's not your home burning down kind of fire. It's not like we didn't start the fire kind of fire. It's not that, but it is a dumpster fire nonetheless.
Exactly. Exactly. All right. So, Tower Heist.
This was a fun movie.
It was way more fun than I expected. I had a friend tell me I didn't like this movie. I got up and left my husband to finish halfway through. And I was like, oh, well, you know, sometimes the best podcasts are shows I don't like very much.
That's, you know what? Some of our best episodes are when we absolutely hated it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which I don't know what that says about us. But I digress.
Yeah. But this is an action comedy crime movie from 2011. There aren't a lot of Thanksgiving movies.
There are not a lot.
But here's one. And it's a U.S. holiday. So if you're going to do a worldwide releasing film, it's not a popular topic.
That's true.
But it's fun here, and this movie actually did okay overseas.
Well, because it's entertaining. It's not centered on Thanksgiving.
No, it's really not. It's not about Thanksgiving, though it happens at Thanksgiving. We'll get there.
We'll get there.
We'll get there.
We'll get there.
Let's talk about this cast.
Oh, okay. Star-studded.
I mean, star-studded. I wish they had been utilized a little better in some ways.
Mm, yeah.
But since these people have been in so many things, I thought I would just mention who they are, what their character is, and where I remember them
from.
Oh,
yes, yes, yes. Let's see.
So Ben Stiller is Josh.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so Reality Bites in 1994. He was in that.
Yes, he was.
That was before he was like screwball comedy dude.
I just totally forgot.
Uh-huh. I mean, like,
because I don't think of him when I think of Reality Bites.
Well, no, I think of Ethan Hawke.
Of course.
But he's like enough of a character that he's on the poster. He's on the cover. Like, his name is on the cover. Gosh. And he is on the cover of the DVD.
Wow. I have to go back and look at pictures. I can't even believe this. I got to go look.
Yep. And his dad was George's dad on Seinfeld.
Right.
Yeah. Eddie Murphy as Slide. I remember him from 1983's Trading Places with Dan Aykroyd. Not because I saw it in 1983 when it came out, but because it would be on the Saturday afternoon movies.
Oh, okay.
In the 80s.
Yeah. 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 You're right. It was. I don't know where I really got to know Eddie Murphy. I feel like he's just ubiquitous. Yeah. You know? Like, he's just always there. He's always been there. He's such a solid, solid actor.
Well, and he was on Saturday Night Live when it started. Yeah, so he was always there. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then Casey Affleck is Charlie. Yes, Ben Affleck's brother.
Oh, he's great.
Yeah.
He's actually a phenomenal dramatic actor.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. I remember him first from Ocean's 11 in 2001, but he was also the little kid in a Kevin Smith movie that I loved called Chasing Amy.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It was a fun little movie. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
So, Alan Alda.
Oh, I love listening to him talk.
Me too.
Ken said the same thing. My husband said the same thing. Yeah. I don't know. Something about the way he speaks is just absolutely fun.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And of course, MASH.
Of course.
The touching comedy about the Korean War that lasted twice as long as the Korean War. It was on for much longer.
Wait, let me follow that.
Yeah.
That's funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a good show.
Then Matthew Broderick is Fitzhugh. Oh, of course. Ferris Bueller.
Of course.
Bueller's Day Off. Another movie that features a parade.
Yes. Bright red car.
Yes. And a bright red car. Yes. Then we have Tia Leone as the FBI agent. Her name is Denim, but you would hardly know that from watching this movie.
Was
Agent Denim. Mm-hmm. They hardly called her that at all.
Hardly. Not many times. Just the agent, the FBI.
Yeah, the FBI is here. I was like, can we give her a name? So I remember her from 1998's Deep Impact, but really what I remember her most was that she was married to David Duchovny from 1997 to 2014.
Oh, that's funny. I don't think I realized that.
Oh, yeah. That was how there's this song, David Duchovny, Why Don't You Love Me? It's so funny.
What?
Oh, my goodness. I'm going to find it and I'm going to put it on our social media because it's hilarious.
That's so funny.
Got all kinds of X-Files references in it. But find us on our social media. You can find us on Facebook, Killer Fun Podcast, Exploring the Intersection of Crime and Entertainment. You can find us on Twitter at Killer Fun Pod, or send me an email, killerfunpodcast@gmail.com. I'll send you a link to the David Duchovny song and send us your hometown crime story. I will send you a link to the David Duchovny song and you can win an entry for this super cool ornament.
Yes.
Then we have Michael Pena, who is Enrique.
Michael Pena is always good.
He's really good. He's really good. And I remember seeing him in ER was the first time I really remember seeing him. He was a cop in three episodes of ER.
Wow, he must have been so young then. Because he's still pretty young. I mean, he's a young guy.
He's got a youthful face, too, I think.
He does.
Really, because that was 2003, and then, of course, this movie was 2011. He looked like he hadn't aged at all.
But he looked like he could play a 15-year-old. Yeah.
For sure. And then, of course, like, his pictures on IMDb, he looks like A baby.
A baby.
Oh, so cute.
He's so good, though. I love everything he's in.
Me too.
I'm obsessed with The Martian right now. I'm just going to tell you that that's like one of, I can watch The Martian at all times, any times, and he's so funny in it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like the movie The Martian?
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
The movie with Matt Damon?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm obsessed. I could watch it on repeat.
Have you read that book?
No.
Oh, it's so good.
But it doesn't have Matt Damon.
Oh, but if you've watched the movie and then you read the book, Matt Damon plays in your brain.
Okay. That's fair.
The book is so good.
I just like to see him dancing to the disco. Uh-huh. It's so funny. Mm-hmm. He's hysterical.
He is hysterical. Then we have Gabri Sidibe, who's Odessa. And of course, she made a big splash in 2009 with her breakout role, Precious.
Yes.
So, yeah. That's everybody.
That's everybody.
Well, I mean,
well,
there's
almost
others.
Everybody. There's tons of people, but that's the main.
Those are like the main cast of characters.
Yes.
A lot of them, maybe too many. Maybe too many?
Mm-hmm. Too many characters?
A little bit. I felt that way about Ocean's 11, too, and this is like half that people.
Oh, gosh.
Half that people? Half the number.
Yeah, half the many people?
Uh-huh, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
No.
I don't think I even thought about that.
Well, that's fine, because this is a movie you don't really have to think very hard about.
That's very, very true, and it was delightful.
It was. So let's recap the delightfulness. All right. So we're introduced to the service industry in luxury high-rise apartments in New York City. It takes an army of people behind the scenes to make the lives of the ultra-wealthy pleasant and or productive. So the Tower is one of the most exclusive and expensive luxury high-rises in New York City, with the average apartment running about $5.6 million in cost. It's managed by Josh, and he reminds his staff that in addition to the opulent surroundings, stellar views, and state-of-the-art security, residents pay for a discreet and dedicated staff. No tips. So we meet Shaw, the penthouse resident, Enrique, a new hire, Odessa, a sassy maid, Charlie, brother-in-law to Josh, and the main concierge lobby man, who is also about to make Josh an uncle.
Yes.
Slide, Josh's neighbor, who's unaffiliated with the Tower, and Fitzhugh, a resident who's being foreclosed upon. Poor Fitzhugh.
He might be my favorite. I think he might be my favorite role in the whole movie.
I mean, I just love Matthew Broderick in anything. And if you make Matthew Broderick like sad and desperate.
Oh, it's so funny.
It's so great.
He plays it so well. And he's just amazing.
Yeah. All right. So there's an emergency. When they realize that the laundry truck is there on the wrong day, Shaw is being kidnapped, and Josh takes his job so seriously that he chases after the laundry truck, only to be intercepted by the FBI because Shaw is being picked up. In addition to being the penthouse owner and number 138 on the Forbes 400 Wealthiest Americans list, Shaw is a fraudster. In addition to his many, many high-profile clients, he has swindled the entire staff of the Tower out of their pensions. And not only that, but Lester the doorman, it gave Shaw even more money on top of his pension, thinking he was about to retire. He attempts suicide. Briefly, you don't see it. It's not a real big trigger warning, I don't think.
Oh, no.
With the suicide attempt.
No, mm-mm. They play it pretty Hitchcock.
Yeah. Shaw's on house arrest awaiting legal proceedings, and Josh, Charlie, and Enrique confront the smooth-talking fraudster. Josh beats up his Steve McQueen Ferrari that Shaw had moved into the penthouse piece by piece, and all three men are fired. So Josh and the FBI agent exchange some information and flirt and drink, and the FBI agent lets slip that Shaw withdrew $20 million in cash just a few months before, and it is missing. Josh enlists Enrique, Charlie, and Evicted with Nothing to Lose Fitzhugh, and their neighbor and probable criminal Slide to help steal the cash and refund everybody's pension investments, at least their initial investment.
Right.
Yeah. The group plans an elaborate and full of holes caper. They arrange for a quote-unquote hearing to take place on Thanksgiving Day so that Shaw and the FBI will be out of the apartment and the staff will be distracted by parties, guests, caterers, and the streets are full and blocked.
Because of the Macy's Day Parade.
That's right, because it's Thanksgiving. This is the perfect cover. Evidently it is, because nobody seems to notice things that are obvious, and I would think that they would notice in a street full of people,
but you would think, but
you suspend your disbelief
because Snoopy is pretty amazing.
Yes, but you're looking up at Snoopy.
How do you miss what's going on up there?
They get double crossed by Slide, but it's thwarted by Odessa, who turns out to also be a safe cracker, and she opens the safe that was hidden, and they find it empty, and then they suddenly realize, and I don't quite remember exactly how, but they realize that the whole car is made out of gold.
Oh, I remember how that happened.
Oh, please tell me.
Because they were fighting over the gun that Slide brought. And so Matthew Broderick goes after the gun, and they're like wrestling like a bunch of idiots. That's right. And the gun goes off. Nearly hits Josh, but hits the car.
Oh, that's right.
When it
right.
does, the paint all kind of chips off the top of the gold. Uh-huh. Because, right. you're not going to bond that.
No.
So that's when Josh sees the gold, and all of a sudden remembers why it was built piece by piece. Uh-huh. Not remembers that it was gold, but remembers that it was built piece by piece, and the fact that that's gold showing, it all kind of comes together.
Yeah, it all. That's it.
And so then he starts beating it.
Yeah. So it's solid gold under the paint, and they steal the vehicle in silly comedy fashion, and the retirements are saved, and Shaw ends up caught, though not for the gold car, but for other stuff.
For the ledger that showed divergence of funds.
That's an excellent way to put it. Divergence of
that
funds.
That was what was written at the top of the ledger in pencil. You don't see it, but briefly, but that's how he wrote it. I thought, what?
Divergence of funds.
Yeah, it was very funny.
It's like putting on the outside of the, you know, bomb.
I mean, seriously, like a cartoon. This is TNT. So, yeah.
Yeah, so he ends up caught, but so does Josh. But Josh is kind of okay with it because it was never really about making money. It was about restoring and making up for the mistake that he made.
Yep.
Fin.
It was so good. I thought the ending was like unique, actually. Uh-huh. Good guys were good guys and bad guys were bad guys. And then you had some in between. You had everybody.
Yeah.
Maybe it was too big. Maybe you were too many people.
It's fine.
I don't know. It was a lot of fun to watch, and it's an easy watch.
Mm-hmm. For sure. Yeah, it did just fine in the box office. It had a $75 million budget and made $150 million worldwide because it's just a fun, silly movie. It was originally conceived by Eddie Murphy.
Oh, okay.
But it started out as a very different kind of movie. Mm-hmm. And so Eddie Murphy wanted an all-black cast of comedians to be the heist group.
Okay.
And they were going to rob Trump International Hotel and Tower.
Oh.
And when they were going through script rewrites, Murphy left the project. And then he came back. But they ended up with this, and it ended up being a little bit different. But it was fine. And all the filming took place in New York City.
That was, I mean, you said the budget. It was a highly produced film. Like, it was.
Really?
That was a high budget. Like, it was legit.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it was funny.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so here's a weird thing that they did that was super ahead of its time for this movie that they almost did but didn't end up doing.
Oh, what's that?
They released the film in early November of 2011, and they were going to release it to 500,000 Comcast customers 3 weeks later as a pay-per-view movie.
Okay.
So it was going to be in theaters and available as a pay-per-view to 500,000 Comcast customers at the same time.
Wow.
The theaters up in arms.
Oh, I can imagine.
They were like, no way. If you do this, we're not going to show the movie.
I can imagine.
So they ended up canceling it, but they were going to charge $60.
What?
$60 pay-per-view dollars.
That's for ridiculous. For this movie.
Which, you know, it's fine, but it's not $60 fine.
I know.
I mean, I guess if you have like 10 people over to watch it.
I guess.
Even then, in 2011, you could see an afternoon movie for $6.
Yeah, no. Yeah. $60 is a little ridiculous.
It was a little ridiculous. They didn't end up doing it. This was going to be their test market to see if this was something feasible and viable that they could do.
You know, from that perspective, I can see why they would make it $60, because it would weed out people who were like, ooh, that's cheap. I can just do it at home.
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't force people to kind of choose it because they were choosing to stay home.
Right.
Which would give them some pretty good information, I suppose. But 60?
Yeah.
Ooh.
Seems ridiculous, but super ahead of its time.
Yeah.
That it would offer that now. That seems like a normal sort of thing in 2020. Like, oh, that movie you were going to put in the movie theater?
No.
Let's just let you buy it for $20 or $30 or $40, however yep. much. Yeah. Or you yep. can wait 3 months and watch it for
less.
Less.
True.
Roger Ebert really appreciated this movie for what it was. He said it's funny in an innocent screwball kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
I appreciated that. It isn't a great heist movie for a lot of reasons, beginning with the stupidity of its heist plan and the impossibility of these characters ever being successful at anything more complex than standing in line.
Oh my gosh! How harsh!
But he didn't hate the movie.
He still liked the movie.
But he had a really good line about it.
Wow.
And he didn't like Ben Stiller in that particular role.
But
there's
really?
Also the problem with Ben Stiller being cast as the hero. He was born to play the victim of heists, not the gang leader.
Oh, see, now I loved him in this role.
I thought it was fine.
I thought yeah. he did a great job.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, not that we can get uber deep about this movie, but his entire life was to serve others, and that's what he did.
Yes, I agree. It wasn't.
And being a building manager is no joke.
Oh, not in that kind of building.
That's like no joke. So.
All right. And the last thing he had to say about it. This movie would fall to pieces if it didn't hurtle headlong through the absurd plot without ever pausing for explanation. And I'm like, that's about right.
That's probably fair. Yeah.
That's about right. All right, we're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back with Is It True? I'm Christy.
And this is Josh.
And we are the Mountains and the Sea.
It's a podcast about Prince and his vast musical output.
We look at each and every Prince album.
And ancillary material like fashion, videos, related artists, B-sides, remixes, outtakes.
We choose a high, the mountain, a low, the sea, and a time capsule.
Yeah, those are her dumb rules, not mine.
Josh is a Prince superfan and has been since long before I met him.
That's right, and I pulled Christy over to the purple side with my wit and my charm.
The music helped. Join us every other week, anywhere you get your podcasts, and happy purple listening, friends. Welcome back. Thanks for sticking with us through that quick break. Is it true?
Is it true? Nothing's true, right?
Some of it's true.
Ooh, what's true? You gotta tell me. I can't wait.
So all those amenities that they had in the tower.
Oh.
Is that a thing? Oh, yeah, it's a thing.
I mean, to just have somebody be like, this kind of cheese, I'll send it to you later.
Uh-huh.
Isn't that the life?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, and that's the kind of thing that you can expect when you have these, like, well, you pay for it because you pay millions of dollars for your apartment.
Yes.
And you pay a monthly fee.
Yeah, so you are paying for the services.
You're paying for the services. So there's an Prevu, P-R-E-V-U, has an article from February, shortly before the world went sideways, giving you suggestions about what you might want in your...
Oh.
If you're seeking a luxury apartment...
Let's talk about
needs versus wants. I'm thinking needs and wants.
At that level?
That's a spectrum that I'm never going to get to enjoy, I don't think.
Like, yeah, I don't know about that. Yeah, probably not.
They call them common charges. Your monthly fees are called common charges.
Okay.
And you want to make sure that whatever your building includes, we're going to pretend that we have millions of dollars.
Okay, to spend millions on an apartment. And millions and millions.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Because you end up, New York's a busy city.
Yeah.
And okay, right now, you probably spend a lot of time at home.
Mm-hmm.
Normally, and when this article is written, you don't spend so much time in your apartment in New York City because there's places to go and things to do.
Okay.
So you want to make sure that the amenities are the things that you actually want.
Now that makes sense.
Right.
That makes sense. I mean, we kind of laugh about this whole, like, they're super rich, what does it matter? But actually, part of the reason they are super rich is because they do pay attention to this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have to be fair.
Right. So you might want a doorman, a concierge, or in package services. Sometimes all of those are wrapped up. So if you have a doorman, he'll probably accept packages for you, but he might not make reservations for you.
Right.
So concierge, a conservation. Almost said a conservation. That's dumb.
we're in a place today. It's funny. Oh Lord.
Okay. You may a washer and dryer in unit. Is a big deal, which I forget sometimes, like having lived in a house for a while and having apartments that always had washer and dryer hookups in the unit.
Yes, I actually did too. All of my apartments always had washer dryer hookups.
Uh-huh.
And I, at the time, I remember knowing that that was a benefit and that's why I liked that complex or whatever.
Right.
But it's been a long time since I've had to think about the fact that what if they don't?
Well, and it's funny that that would be such a benefit because the people in this movie didn't seem like they were doing their own laundry, like, ever.
No.
But I guess it would be nice to have a washer and dryer if you have some sort of accident or
For your personal things, you may have your in-house.
Oh, your housekeeper might.
Housekeeper might be doing laundry and that kind of keeps your stuff in-house.
Washing your delicates.
Versus having to send them out.
Mm. An elevator, pet-friendly spa, outdoor space, pool, fitness center, those sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
You have to decide what's on your list for there. And then there's some, like, nice-to-have things.
Okay, so, I can't wait to read
like,
these.
A golf simulator or a media room with a 100-inch television screen.
Ooh.
Those kinds of things. And he said, but those are probably going to end up being things more to impress your friends. Unless you're a huge movie buff or an avid golfer, those are probably not things you're going to use all the time.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
That
so
makes sense.
To keep in mind.
When we move to the tower.
Yeah, that's right. You know, do they have a pet spa?
Do we have a pool in our penthouse on the roof?
Does it have Benjamin Franklin on the bottom?
I mean, seriously.
Mm-hmm. Odessa?
Mm-hmm.
Could crack a safe in 15 minutes.
Yeah, because, she seemed to have a knack for that.
Yeah, because her dad was a...
locksmith.
A locksmith.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So chances are good she probably wouldn't have been able to do it in 15 minutes. Even if she could, she wasn't really old enough because according to Francesco Thurso, who's been a safecracker for 40 years in Providence, Rhode Island. He said it takes about 20 years of regular experience to get really good at it.
Okay.
And I'm thinking unless she's cracking a lot of safes in her, as part of her maid position.
Yeah, she hadn't done it in a long time.
Well,
she had moved here from Jamaica.
Uh-huh.
Was looking for a husband.
Uh-huh.
Because her visa was expiring. And her dad back in Kingston was the locksmith. So she hadn't done this in a while.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe she had. Now, that's the movie I want to see.
I know, right?
I want to see Sassy Maid Odessa.
Yeah. Put her in your earphones and, like, no drill. It kind of reminded me of Italian Job.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? Where at the end, like, she has to do it old school, you know?
Yep. So the way they did it in the movie was manipulation. And this is way more complicated than they would make it seem in most entertainment. They always make it seem like no big deal. You could do it in 15 minutes.
Yeah. But
it requires a lot of patience. It is the most discreet way, but you need a lot of time. And it's considered the most affluent way to break into a... Yes.
Because they're doing it by hearing the pins move and drop inside and...
Yeah. Well, and you have to determine how many wheels there are.
Yeah.
Which is there's a wheel for each number. You have to determine how many wheels there are. You have to determine how many contact points because they each wheel might not only have one contact point, it might have several with a little the mechanism that falls into place. It might not just be one spot. It might be more than one
spot. So if you heard it click on the wrong one, then the puzzle wouldn't fit when it fell.
Right. Exactly. And most safecrackers will actually end up graphing their results to be able to find the most likely combination. So you would go through and you'd figure out how many contact points you have, how many wheels there are. You'd graph those based on the information that you get when you're listening, then you would figure out, okay, there's this many numbers, this many options, and then try them all.
Right. So or narrow it down based on reconnaissance you've done. Maybe you know them well enough that if you can narrow down a certain something, you might be able to go, okay.
That's assuming that you set your own code.
Yeah, that's true.
So because there are many safes that come pre-programmed.
And that's it?
And that's it. You can't change them.
Oh, that sounds like a whole other crime movie.
On the social media, I also put a really interesting article about a guy who was a locksmith in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. It's fascinating. It was way more to go into because that wasn't really like the main gist of all this.
Yeah. But
it was fascinating. All right, so I thought the most famous Steve McQueen car was a Mustang. And I was like, why do they keep calling it the Ferrari? Well, the most famous Steve McQueen car that he had in a movie was a Mustang.
Okay.
His movie Bullet.
Okay.
That's the car he drove. And the most expensive Mustang that's ever sold was for $3.75 million.
Ooh.
And it was one of the cars that was used in that movie.
Okay.
So I was like, oh, I was not wrong.
You were not wrong. It was a Mustang, not a Ferrari.
But there is a Ferrari.
Okay.
That Steve McQueen owned. He loved cars. He was in tons of car movies. He had a Ferrari that was delivered to him on the set of The Bullet.
Oh, I see. I see. Okay. So
he did have a Ferrari. It just recently sold, I think, for about $10 million.
Whoa!
In 2014.
Wow.
It was a Ferrari 275 GTB4 from the late 60s. And those cars will typically run you $3 million. So the fact that Shaw said he paid $1 million for it would have been incorrect.
No, yeah, that would have been way under.
Even if it was really a real Steve McQueen car.
Yeah.
That he paid $1 million for it.
Please, wouldn't have, no, that wouldn't have worked at all.
It wouldn't have been anything.
They were far off.
They were super far off. But the Ferrari that he took possession of that was delivered to him on set while they were filming Bullet went for, it was about $10 million.
Oh my gosh, that is so much money for a car.
Yeah. Well, and they said the only reason that it went for that much is because it belonged to Steve McQueen.
Definitely.
They were like, you can buy a car in similar condition, very, very nice, for millions less is the cachet behind owning Steve McQueen's.
Of course, of course.
Is well, it that worth kind that of much?
Memorabilia.
And for some people it is.
Yeah, some yeah. people will pay much, much more for the sentimental value, but I just, wow, with the cars. I just,
yeah, I know.
You know, I'm not in it. I'm not there.
So in the movie, mm-hmm. it wasn't really Steve McQueen's car.
No, it wasn't.
And it wasn't Steve McQueen's car in the movie. So when they filmed it, they made a replica because they decided it was way too expensive to get a Ferrari at like $3 million. I see why.
Uh-huh.
That was, I mean, even with an $75-85 million budget, millions of dollars out of their budget yeah. would have been too much just to have the actual car, especially
right.
when they were going to beat on it a
oh,
little
yeah.
bit.
Oh, yeah. No, no, no.
No, no, no. So they made a replica.
Uh-huh.
But then, of course, they made a replica. Shaw made a replica because he was hiding his gold.
Right.
Right. Fitzhugh does some quick math.
Oh, yes. Very, very quick math. Couldn't follow it at all.
Me either. The price of gold per ounce, 2,000-pound car, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was way off.
Oh, really?
Okay, let me tell you why.
Okay, okay.
Because steel and gold have very, very different densities.
Right, okay.
So if you have the standard trade for gold is the bars, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So they weigh 400 troy ounces each.
Okay.
So if you had a gold bar, that 400 troy ounces, it would weigh 31, 33 pounds, somewhere in there.
Okay.
If you had a steel bar of the exact same size, it would only weigh 13 pounds.
Okay.
So it's about 2.5 times as dense gold is over steel.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay.
So if you had a car that weighed 2,000 pounds when it was made out of steel.
Mm-hmm.
If you made the same car with the same parts out of gold, okay. it would weigh much more.
Right. Okay.
Okay. I did the math.
You did the math?
I did the okay. math. I had to have my son, who's in pre-calculus, like help me figure out how to do this math.
Okay.
It would weigh about 4,900 pounds.
Okay, now that makes sense.
Yeah.
All right, because 2,000 pounds steel
right.
means about
right.
whatever.
So, based on that, I looked up the cost of gold for okay. Thanksgiving Day 2011. And I did more math.
More math?
So the car, and it wouldn't have even been the right kind of ounce because regular ounces, 16 ounces to a pound,
mm-hmm.
and the ounces they measure gold in are troy ounces.
Okay.
And those are different. A troy ounce is slightly smaller than a regular ounce.
Well, why do they do that?
I don't know.
Okay. I digress.
Rich people doing rich stuff.
I don't understand. I mean, it makes no sense to me. Okay. But, okay, so math.
So the car weighing 4,900 pounds-ish.
Okay.
I think it was 4,922, something like that.
Okay.
If you converted that to troy ounces, it would be 71,779 troy ounces.
Okay.
The value at the end of the day on Thanksgiving Day for a troy ounce of gold in 2011.
Uh-huh.
Was $1,692.50 per ounce.
Okay.
Okay. So if it was troy ounces instead of regular ounces and the actual density of gold instead of the equivalent in steel, the value of that car in gold alone would have been $121.5 million.
Whoa!
He was much closer if the car had actually weighed 2,000 pounds.
Right.
That was like $54 million. Because
okay.
they said, it's worth $45 million, give
yeah.
or take $10 million.
Yes, he did say that.
Give or take $10 million.
Right.
It would have been, It would have been relatively close, $54 million.
So when they said 2,000 pounds, they meant that's what the Ferrari would weigh. Yes. Not what they estimated the actual weight to be at that moment.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. So a Ferrari of that make and model
would have been about
2,000 pounds.
Okay. Well, maybe that's why Fitzhugh lost his job at Wall Street.
That's what I was thinking. Would you, if we were to sell that car full of gold
today,
it's not dramatically different.
Okay.
$134 million. Oh. I mean, don't get me wrong. Anybody wants to give me the difference, the $13 million difference? I'd take it off your hands.
Sure.
But,
oh, that's interesting. That is so much money in gold.
In gold.
I get gold, but I don't really get it either.
It's a human construct, just like everything.
It is. It is a total human construct.
I mean, they're like, oh, you shouldn't keep cash because it's not backed by gold. Like, okay, but why is gold valuable?
I don't know why gold's valuable.
Gold's valuable because we all agree that it's valuable.
Yeah, I feel like that has to be it. I mean, I don't understand what the...
I mean, it's got uses, but not...
Not like other things not have uses.
$1,800 of...
No.
For 14 ounces or whatever.
Yeah, I don't really understand it.
I don't. I mean, whatever.
Okay. Yeah.
Anyway, so based on the weight of the gold versus the weight of steel, then we have the crane.
This was so funny.
Okay, so they pull the car out with the crane for the window washing.
Yeah, it's the crane. It's like the building's crane, though.
Right.
Right? Yeah. So, you know, it's probably pretty...
Yeah.
You know,
well,
most of them do have a pretty substantial crane on top.
Yeah. But I was like, well, would it really be able to hold it?
I don't know.
Yes, probably.
Okay, good.
Probably because OSHA requirements state that the cranes that will have a worker on them on something that's they have to be able to support 5,000 pounds in any direction per person. On the item. So if you have a window washing, if you're only going to have one person, it has to support 5,000 pounds.
Right, if you're going to have two,
it has to support 10,000 pounds. So even if there was one person, it was only rated for one person, then
it would still be like 5,000 pound rating.
It would be close once you put the three men on it, which there were three men on it at one point.
Yeah.
It would have been close.
It would have been close.
But probably still could have done it. But if you figure it's a big building, they might need more than one window washer out there at a time.
Mm-hmm.
Well within.
Okay.
Isn't that weird?
I kind of guessed that, actually.
Okay.
This is, I actually expected the crane to be
quite something that I looked at. Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you expect me to look it up?
No.
Oh, okay.
I did not at all. Okay. I did not see that one coming at all.
Okay, because I always wonder, is Jackie going to figure out? It's like, always a surprise.
I know, and that's what I love about it.
Is she going to know what I looked up?
I don't know what you look up. This is why it's so fun, because you tell me these things. But then, like, it's weird, because I'm like, oh, I did think that that crane would be okay for that.
Like, I didn't really question it.
I didn't
until
question it.
Until at the end, I was like, oh, that car weighed much more than I would have anticipated.
And then you thought, what about the crane?
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, could the crane have even done that? Probably.
Yeah. Yeah. Alrighty.
All right.
Good
psych,
to know.
Psych break. Just a quick note. Our psychology break today deals with suicide. I wanted to give you a warning about that. We don't talk about anything graphic, and Jackie has a lot of great information to share. But if you're not in a place where you can hear that right now, please skip ahead about 15 minutes and we finish up that discussion.
Psych break.
All right. So I kind of latched on to Lester.
Oh,
sweet Lester the doorman, who lost not only all his retirement, but all of his savings. He'd given his $73,000 in savings that he'd worked
29 years for.
29 years to save. And he was excited to go retire with his lady friend in San Diego. And all of his money was gone. He all was sad. It. Every bit. So he tried to step in front of a train and they were, played it very well. He got saved, but he ended up in the hospital on a psychiatric hold.
Yes.
Which is just basically the ability for a doctor to require a person mm-hmm. who might be a danger to themselves or others to remain in the hospital for 48 hours.
Yep.
That's really all it means. There is thought. Sarah Pintilli mm-hmm. wrote for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram that she thinks that the 48-hour hold is not long enough.
Mm.
That this is in Texas. They can put you on a 48-hour hold. It right. varies state to state. I would say that's pretty typical.
That's pretty typical.
24, 48, 72
yeah.
are all within general guidelines. So she said that in a 48-hour hold, the time that medical staff actually spend with a patient is severely limited.
Mm-hmm.
And that there's paperwork that has to be done. You have to evaluate patient responsiveness. If it's weekends, that makes a difference. And submitting the paperwork, all of that stuff takes time. And all of that is included because the 48 hour starts when they step in the ER.
Mm-hmm.
So even if they aren't seen for several hours, their 48 hours started when they got to the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And even if they're spending part of that time filling out paperwork to be able to stay,
mm-hmm.
then that counts as their 48 hours. So it makes it really difficult for physicians to assess their condition when there may be 12, 14, 16 hours when they don't even really see the patient.
Yeah.
And that she says that she thinks that a 72-hour hold would give them a chance to have two mornings.
Okay.
And that helps them get into a little bit of a routine and they can see how they're responding to medications that they've been given. And she's advocating for a slightly longer hold so that people who need medication and stuff aren't released too early and that they can really have a chance to be evaluated. And she's coming at this as a child of an alcoholic. The doctor released her mom after like 36 hours and mm-hmm. she was yelling at the doctor because she is 20 years old. And it was like, my mom's a mess and she's been a mess my whole life, basically. And you're going to release her and she's going to die.
I have a lot of compassion for what she's saying.
Yeah. Do you think 48 hours is enough?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes. Wholesale. I don't mind a state having 72 because in the rare instance, I feel like they see it as a necessary tool that they could use it. I could see some instances where a 72 might give them an opportunity. But when you're in an involuntary hold, this is prison.
Right.
This person is not just in the hospital. This is prison. That means they're there against their will.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be careful, I think, of autonomy with that because you're saying not only are you in prison, but you're actually not even in prison for breaking the law yet.
Yeah.
This is like a precog situation, like minority report.
Oh, okay.
Right? And then you're saying, because we're afraid of you doing something, we're going to hold you. Then we're going to take away all your autonomy to really say yes and no to medication, to treatment. You've taken away everything from this individual who is already hopeless. So it's already kind of a risky business. It's really an emergency thing so that everybody else can kind of figure out what's going on and hopefully it works. But the truth is you really want them to check in voluntarily if they need residential or if they were in some sort of delusional state or had a psych break or something like that, it doesn't take long to stabilize that.
Okay.
The medicines that you're getting for like if somebody who was dealing with hallucinations or something and that they were going to pop you with a shot, you're going to be lucid within a few hours.
Oh, okay.
So it's not like a medicine that most people might be familiar with, like that you might get prescribed for you know, depression or anxiety, even not from a psychiatrist. You might get it from your primary. Mm-hmm. Those things take like weeks upon weeks to find out how you're doing with it.
Right.
Okay. Okay. Not these shots. Okay. These shots are fast.
Oh, okay.
Lithium is fairly fast.
Yeah.
Right. Like, so they can stabilize and transfer, and hopefully they can do that within that time. But at the same time, you're still holding somebody against their will. Mm-hmm. The more strong you make that, the more you're cornering somebody, and the less opportunity you're really going to have to try to redirect the ship. So, and a person who's been a mess their whole lives, that extra 2 days isn't changing anything.
Okay.
If this person, if her mom was so, so sick that she was on a 48-hour hold and should have been a mess her whole life, extending that another day ain't doing anything.
Right.
This person needs to be involuntarily institutionalized is the old word. Uh-huh. But like, there are some legal methods that you might be able to take to declare a person incompetent and things. But the truth is, you don't get to decide what other people do. And as much as that pains you, mm-hmm. as a daughter, as a parent, you just don't get to. Mm. That is our law. And the moment you have something going on with you where you don't want to take that treatment,
right.
that law is going to become very, very important to you.
Right.
To get to decide that. Unfortunately, okay. freedom also means the freedom to destroy your own life.
Yeah.
And that's hard.
And sometimes that also means they have the freedom to destroy their children's lives and a little
that
bit.
That sucks.
It
so
does.
Bad.
It's terrible. But
you know, you can't, you can only do so much before you're like, okay, but you've got to find a more creative way to do this. Mm-hmm. You know, like if her life was a mess her whole life, where was CPS?
Right.
We're not dealing with this when you're 20 and yelling at doctors. That was a problem for family services when you were much, much younger. And at that point, the state could have done something.
Right.
For at least the daughter.
Right.
And required some things. If she was that hot of a mess, I'm sure there's something legal that we could charge her with that would actually put her in jail. You know, see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. This one thing, that's grasping at straws. And I get it, but it's not the solution.
Okay. That's interesting.
Yeah. My two cents anyway.
Yeah. 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 And then, common knowledge is that people who try and commit suicide are mentally ill. And that is actually, now this article's a little old, 2012, but it was kind of early, I think, maybe mm-hmm. in this research, that there were a number of Asian studies, and they were examined by Pridmore Saxby and Reddy Anil in their academic article. That said that suicide was very often associated with major financial loss.
It can be. People have a lot of misinformation or a lot of chaotic information about suicide. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, and that in the studies that they were looking at, they found that about 50% of the people in Asian cultures who were considering or attempting suicide mm-hmm. had a major financial loss and had no history of mental illness, no mental illness otherwise that could be ascertained, that it was just this traumatic financial episode mm-hmm. that caused them to seek a very dramatic and permanent solution.
Well, and it's interesting because this is studying Asian cultures mm-hmm. and that may not generalize to other cultures.
No, that's
However,
certainly true.
It's still not wrong. It's a little bit of that circular logic, right? If you commit suicide, you must have been mentally ill.
Right.
And if you're mentally ill, you might commit suicide. Well, okay. But there's different types of suicide attempts, mm-hmm. right? There's different types.
Right.
You know, you do have that dramatic response to major life events and trauma that can cause all kinds of things. You might not be mentally ill per se, as in you have a disorder, but you might be mentally broken at that moment, mm-hmm. right? So that's not, it's not a falsehood that you have some mental emotional disturbances going on.
Right.
It may not be chronic.
Right.
It might be acute.
Right.
And an acute situation can cause that. On the other hand, there's a lot of other misinformation. For instance, when certain types of individuals who have been dealing with chronic illnesses finally make a decision to kill themselves, mm-hmm. which is tragic, they often show what's called a flight into health. They become happy. Mm. They become very ecstatic. They become loving. They might start giving things away. Mm. They might even throw a party. They might And everybody around them is like, oh, good.
They're better.
They're better. The clouds are breaking through. Like, yay. If it's dramatic, you know, you might want to check up and just verify your assumption. Find out why they're better.
Yeah.
Find out what's going on there. Because unfortunately, the relief of having made the decision that you're not going to live in that trauma anymore is so, you know, euphoric almost,
right,
that they are finally happy. Aww. Which is why it's so hard for friends and family, because they're like, they were finally getting better. Oh no,
they weren't really getting better.
Actually,
it's kind of like the cancer patient who stops chemo and then they get better. They seem like they're getting much better,
much better,
because they've stopped the chemo, but then that just allows the cancer to progress.
Yeah.
It's a similar situation.
Sort of flight into health.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, and that doesn't describe all suicidal situations, but, you know, but that's why understanding more about suicide and mental illness is so important, that people understand that. And it's also important to understand that while it is important to know that we are treating others with kindness and not causing them stress and trauma in their lives, because that's not okay. It is not okay for somebody to have trauma put into their lives that would cause them to be suicidal by other people who are treating them awfully, oppressing them, hurting them, abusing them. It is not okay. At the same time, you also can't blame suicide on somebody else. Which is so hard, because for the person who is in that moment, they can blame. They can tell you why all the things these people did drove them there. And that might be very real to them. But for those left behind, you have to know that you didn't cause it. You aren't a murderer. It wasn't your fault. So that's a really hard thing to hold in tension, is to know that, you know, this is why you should just be a decent human. But on the other hand, you can't take responsibility for somebody else's decision. But you also shouldn't go around being awful to people and driving them to this thing. So, you know, so when we say check in on people, we're not saying it's your responsibility to save their lives.
No.
We're just saying responsibility to be a decent human and be kind. And if there is something that you're capable of knowing and capable of doing, then you take that. And if you didn't know and you're not capable of doing that, it's not your fault. You didn't cause it.
That's a really important reminder.
We do a lot of disservice to people because we have these major like suicide prevention campaigns, and we go tell people, check on your friends. How many people have seen this on Facebook? Go check on your friends. They're not as happy as you think they are. Da 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 da. As if we're responsible for somebody else's attempt to take their own life.
Right.
No.
You check on your friends because you love your friends and you want them to know that you care about them. Mm-hmm. You're not responsible for that behavior.
So it's good. Yes, go check on your friends. It is a wonderful reminder, especially when we all get busy in life, as a reminder to say, hey, go check on people. They might need you. But if something's going wrong and you didn't check and you just saw that Facebook post, lay down the guilt.
Right.
You don't get to be God either way. You don't get to take somebody else's life, and you don't get to be the one who prevents it.
Right.
If you happen to be in that place where you realize somebody's in trouble and you can help them, that's because you're a decent human and you're a kind person, not because it was your responsibility. So I just have to put that out there.
Okay.
A lot of guilt in families over suicide that doesn't need to be there.
Right.
Suicide causes a trauma on those who are left behind.
Right.
And it's a guilt that most people don't quite understand.
Mm.
And that needs to be just as much
addressed as suicide prevention.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Survivors guilt is a real thing.
It's a real thing.
And it's not something that you need to harbor.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. All right. Rant's over.
Real life. It seems to me that the average value of $5.6 million per unit wouldn't have been really high enough for the exclusive luxury building in New York City.
I thought this too, actually.
Yeah. And it's, let's just say, substantially more.
Okay.
Now, of course, this is only the 9 most expensive penthouses in August of 2019 in New York City. Now, I'm not going to go over all of them, but I mean, much, much more. So, at 172 Madison Avenue, $98 million.
Oh my gosh.
For an apartment.
Oh my gosh.
20,000 square feet next to the Empire State Building. 5 floors.
What? That's not a house?
Yeah.
It's not a condo.
It's the top 5 floors. And it didn't ever really occur to me that they would cross more than one floor. I think you'd be like, oh, it's a big building. You have a whole floor.
Mm-hmm.
But 5 floors. That's what you get for $98 million and a gorgeous view and 11 bedrooms and 14 bathrooms. And
I don't.
A lot of amenities, I would assume.
Yeah, I don't understand that kind of space, I guess.
Well,
I live in a tiny house right now.
You do.
Right?
You do live in a little bit.
And that's good.
House,
I love this season of my life. It's really interesting. Mm-hmm. It's really fun. And I adore it. And I could just as easily go back to a 3,000 square foot house like I had before.
Right.
And do the whole thing. I kind of love houses in general. Like, yeah. I probably could accumulate many of them and be very happy about it. I don't think I'd want 5 floors at 20,000 square feet.
I mean, not for my size of a family.
There's
4 of us and a dog.
It gives me thoughts, though. Like, now I'm like, what would I do? What would I do with those 5 floors?
Let's see.
20,000
You have
square feet.
One, everybody gets their own floor, and then you have a common floor.
Oh, that's kind of delightful. I mean, because, you know, we're all in this pandemic, and, like, when was the last time we were alone? It's like so many people out there are like, I am never alone. Uh-huh. I actually went to work yesterday and I was there forever.
Yeah.
And it flew by because I was by myself for the first time in like, I don't know when. I don't know that maybe that's, maybe I do want this. Maybe it is on my wish list.
Well, let's see. Or we could go a little more affordable.
Oh, okay.
The Woolworth Tower residence, $79 million for the penthouse, 9,700 square feet. So about half the square footage for $20 million less.
Oh, wow.
The Madison Square Park Tower was $77.7 million. And that's for the raw space. That's for... like
the just the loft, just
the your 13,000 square feet, but it's not like finished walls and all that.
Wow,
that's the raw space. You have to finish it yourself.
Oh my gosh.
Uh-huh. But it comes with 2 studio apartments in the building.
Why?
Guest places, rental properties. I mean, because, you know, if you spend $77 million on your place.
Maybe that's where the housekeeper lives. Like, maybe the butler lives there, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, you have guest quarters and staff quarters.
Mm-hmm. It's mind-blowing.
212 Fifth Avenue, $63 million will get you 10,000 square feet of interior space and 5,700 square feet of terraces. Sounds okay to me.
Wow.
That includes a ballroom and an observatory in your apartment.
Wow.
Yeah. That's something you do with 10,000 square feet. You have a ballroom.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. And then the least expensive one on the list, a paltry $57 million at West 57th Street, 2 blocks from Central Park, on a strip of property that's called Billionaire's Row. So, I mean, I guess you know who your neighbors are.
Wow.
7,100 square feet and 14-foot ceilings.
Wow.
I could do with that.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, it's still not like my first choice is like, that's not where my heart would be as far as like a home.
Uh-huh.
Like, I'd rather live in, like, where Neil Caffrey did. but,
yes. Yes. And
if I want that kind of space, I want, like, a home built by Frank Lloyd Wright.
Yeah.
On a beach. but also in a mountain. So, like, Northern California area.
Oh.
And do the whole... that's what I would... That would be
You
want to
live where they filmed The Birds.
Yes.
My brother lives near there.
I want one of his homes.
Gorgeous and
yes,
on fire way too much.
Oh, I know. It's just terrible. But yeah, that's the kind of home I would want as an amazing, like, you know, something from a Frank Lloyd Wright or, mm-hmm. you know, anyways, but I just, wow, that's
yeah,
like,
it's a lot of money. So Josh was encouraged to hire Enrique because he had Native American ancestry.
Enrique. It's from the Golden Girls. Enrique Mas. Sorry. I digress.
In September of 2020, after all of the riots about social justice, uh-huh. a lot of big companies are looking at quotas for different ethnicities mm-hmm. to make sure that they're being more representative. So it's kind of a thing that's happening more. Now, of course, there's no consequences. They don't meet their quotas.
Right. It's all an initiative.
It's all initiative and internal, but I appreciate that they're trying to be mm-hmm. more diverse, get more diverse voices. Hey, put some women in leadership because companies do great when they have women in leadership.
More diversity means more productivity and typically is associated with higher gross income mm-hmm. and net. So it's important. Quotas are hard because they only work in the short term.
Right.
They don't really work in the long term.
Right.
Because like any system.
Yeah.
But in the short term, it can help to spearhead a change of direction.
Right. And the one thing that the article pointed out, it was from Bloomberg, Maren Wolf and Kim Bashan wrote it. They said one of the things that you have to be careful of is that it can actually put a limiting on the number of different ethnicities. Oh, we already have 12% Black people on this particular department. We don't need any more.
Right. That's the flip side of it. That's why it's really just it's an acute kind of fix it fast and make some quick changes. But
it needs to be a cultural shift. Mm-hmm. And these kinds of quotas can push it in that direction.
They can. It's part of affirmative action. The whole plan mm-hmm. with affirmative action was a kind of a shotgun approach. Mm-hmm. Have a bit of a quota to help direct it and then have like racial sensitivity training. And then, you know, it was like a multifaceted sort of training program to try to create new culture. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, because if you do give a quota, it gives somebody an anchor to negotiate with, right? It's like an anchor. And then they're kind of like, well, now I can just stay here. No, that's not the point.
Yeah.
But so you have to be kind of careful with how you use those quotas.
Well,
but.
And yeah, they can be used for good mm-hmm. and nefariousness.
And nefarious.
All right. So Shaw.
Oh, Shaw.
He was based on a real person.
Yes, he was.
Bernie Madoff. Oh my gosh. The Ponzi scheme.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know a ton about him. And I read more about him.
Yeah.
I don't know why he did it.
Oh, I don't know why any of them do it.
This guy didn't need it. All right, let's talk about it a little bit. He had claimed that he was using a real trading strategy called split strike conversion. And he said he was just really good at it. And he worked with his sons. And he confessed to them that they thought he was just a trading genius.
Mm-hmm.
And he confessed to them that he was actually at the end of the Ponzi scheme, where he could no longer raise the capital he needed to pay off because the way the Ponzi scheme works mm-hmm. is that you get money from investors and then you get more money from other investors and you pay off your first investors with their profit that you've promised them with the money you get from the later investors. And you always need new investors coming in so you can pay off the whole process. So you have the people here who've invested mm-hmm. and the more people invest, and then you pay the money to the original people with the new money. And then you have to pay off those other people with more new money coming in. So you need new money all the time. He was mm-hmm. really good at it. But you know, all things come to an end, and the financial crisis in 2008 put an end to it. And his children turned him in.
Really?
His sons.
I didn't know that.
That he worked with. Yes. That he told them one night, this is what's happening. And they turned him in the next day.
Oh my gosh.
I know. Good for them.
Good for them.
We'll get there though.
Oh, no.
So he pleaded guilty to 11 felony counts and was sentenced to 150 years in prison and ordered to forfeit $170 billion in assets.
Wow.
I mean, so much. Now, it all started, he'd raised money, he'd saved money. Now, at the age of 22, he was trading penny stocks in a business that he started for $5,000.
Okay.
And he made that $5,000 by installing sprinklers and working as a lifeguard. Now, $5,000 in 1960 is the same as $41,000 today. Can you imagine somebody who installs sprinklers and works as a lifeguard being able to save up $41,000?
No.
Me either. And that's a whole different issue. But I'm not even going to go into. But he did this. And he ran into some issues. But then he and his brother figured out how to do electronic trading.
Okay.
And so that's how he got really wealthy and really famous, was because they figured out how to do this electronic trading and use computers to do it. And it like revolutionized stock trading. And by the late 80s, he was making $100 million a year.
Oh my God. I can't even.
I mean, it's so much money. It's so much money. Madoff testified that he started doing the Ponzi scheme in 1991.
Wow.
Yeah. After he was already making $100 million a year. Yeah. Account manager at the firm that he owned said that fraud had been occurring for as long as he could remember. So there had always been some shady business going on. But Bernie Madoff said he didn't actually start his Ponzi scheme till 1991. And he said, I had more money to support any of my lifestyle and my family's lifestyle. I didn't need to do this. I don't know why I did it. Like, he literally didn't understand why he even did it.
I mean,
because he was already making $100 million a year. And it was just kind of a, I'm going to do it because I can.
I guess I wonder, I mean, the stocks are not solid, especially if you're doing that kind of more risky trading. I guess I could see how he would think, okay, well, if it's all about investors, then it's all under his control all the time.
Right.
He gets to con people and then he gets to take it and not have to worry actually about what if the stock market actually crashes.
Right.
Right. Like, but he didn't think far enough ahead to be like, well, if the stock market crashes, the investors go away.
Uh-huh.
Maybe he planned to be out of it before that. Maybe
that was like one thing he said he was going to do it only for a short amount of time and then just never left. Just kept doing it until it was.
What I want to know is, with that amount of money, how they don't actually own shares in anything, right? Mm-hmm. That's the point, right? Like, he never actually invested them.
Right. He told them he invested it, but he didn't.
Right. So I feel like at some point somebody should have recognized that the companies weren't getting the money.
You'd think, but people are overlook a lot when they're getting a large return.
Yeah.
In Tower Heist, he said, we can triple our pensions.
Mm-hmm.
And if it sounds too good to be true, it's probably
too
good.
It probably is true.
Yeah. Unfortunately, Mark Madoff, one of Bernie's sons, committed suicide 2 years after they turned his father in, and his other son died of cancer in 2014.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. So
that's horrific.
Super, super sad. But you know what? I have a lot of respect for Judge Denny Chin, because Bernie Madoff is dying of kidney disease, and Denny Chin, Judge Chin, said, I don't care. you're going to stay in prison because Bernie Madoff wanted compassionate release after serving 10 years of a 150-year sentence. He didn't go to prison until he was in his 70s.
Now, did people get their money back?
I don't think so.
Because
some of it, but not all of it.
I mean, I feel like at the end of it, that's the problem, right? They seize all these assets, but it goes to pay off who? Who gets this money?
Well, I mean, some people got some of their money back, but nobody got all of their money back, I don't think. Yeah, a staggering human toll is what Judge Chin said, that, and that even if he was dying, he didn't deserve a compassionate release because of how many people he had damaged, and that he felt like Mr. Madoff was never truly remorseful. There are over 500 people sent letters in to the judge to tell them, to tell him that their life had been severely impacted.
Oh my gosh.
And here's how, and don't release him.
Wow.
Yeah. I'm like,
that's big.
That's big. Those are just the ones that got notification that they needed to write a letter. Mm-hmm. There were
tens of thousands more
who were defrauded by him.
Yeah. And like in the movie, it seems like, okay, they're the smallest account, and the FBI agent, Agent Denham, mm-hmm. was like, you're the smallest account, you're not getting your money back. And I'm like, shouldn't they start with all the smallest accounts first?
You would think.
I feel like they should start with all the smallest accounts, or anybody who, like, lost everything first.
Well, or, hey, we're going to split it up evenly mm-hmm. until you're... Yeah. Start with the smallest accounts. Like, you split it up evenly. And then if somebody has money left over, then you add it to the next smallest one until you can start paying out more.
Yeah. I feel like,
you get to a threshold where.
I mean, no offense. I know that it's irritating for all the people who lost tons of money, the larger accounts. And I totally get that. But on the other hand, like.
The little guy is the one who
can't recover. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Bernie Madoff, not a good guy. All right. Last thing.
Okay.
The Thanksgiving Day Parade. If you've watched it already today, you know that it looks a little different, but let's talk about how it looks a little different. So it's been running since 1926. It's had balloons since 1929. But they are going to have balloons. They're just going to be different. They're going to be not have all the volunteers. That's a huge thing. Uh-huh. People love to volunteer to hold the balloons down and walk the parade route. This is a huge thing. They're having the balloons attached to special vehicles to be able to move them around.
Because they can't have all those people.
They can't have all those people. I totally get it. Mm-hmm. I appreciate that they're doing something to change it. All of the live performances, like live performances, quote unquote live performances, because they're never live. Uh-uh. They're all lip synced. All of those performances are being pre-recorded.
Okay.
So it's going to look a little different this year.
Yeah, it's going to look a little different.
But, all right, so next time. We're going to talk about Veronica Mars.
I can't wait to finally dive into this.
The first two episodes, it's Magnum P.I. meets the Gilmore Girls.
I'm so excited.
It's adorable.
Okay, I've been meaning to watch this for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's time.
Yeah, and now it's time.
Yes.
I'm going to pull you on in.
Yes.
Well, and... It was on UPN.
Okay.
And then UPN changed to the CW, mm-hmm. and they didn't keep Veronica Mars around. But Hulu bought the rights to it. Mm-hmm. So now it's a Hulu original because they rebooted it for like 8 episodes in 2019.
And we're watching the original.
We're watching the original, the first 2 episodes. Yes. So back from 2004, I think. Ooh. Yeah. So it's cute. There's a lot of old tech. And
that is the most amazing thing because tech moves so fast now that it doesn't take long for like an entire show to just be full of anachronisms everywhere. Like nothing makes sense anymore. It's all out of place. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, don't forget to rate and review and share with a friend because it's super fun. And send us your hometown crime stories. KillerFunPodcast@gmail.com. Until then, be safe, be kind, and wash your hands. Bum, bum, bum. Bum, bum. Da, 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 da.